Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Alice Bryant. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Ukraine is asking the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, for help after Russia seized three Ukrainian naval ships and their crews. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko urged NATO countries to send naval ships to the Sea of Azov. His comments were reported in the German newspaper Bild. Poroshenko said Ukraine's NATO allies were needed to provide security after Russian forces seized the ships and their crews on Sunday. He told the newspaper the seizures showed that Russian President Vladimir Putin wants nothing less than to occupy the sea. The Ukrainian government has said Russia is blocking shipping activity to and from Ukrainian ports near the Sea of Azov and the Kerch Strait. The Kerch Strait connects the Sea of Azov with the Black Sea. Russia denies it is restricting shipping in the area. It has said the Ukrainians were violating Russian waters and that Ukraine did not inform Russian officials of its naval movements. Ukraine denies this. Poroshenko said sending NATO ships would send a clear message to Putin. The only language he understands is the unity of the Western world, he said. Earlier this week, NATO released a statement condemning Russia's use of military force against Ukraine. The alliance called on Russia to provide unrestricted access to Ukrainian ports and permit freedom of navigation. The United States and other countries have also criticized the Russian actions in the Kerch Strait. On Thursday, U.S. President Donald Trump announced that he was canceling planned talks with Putin over the issue. The two leaders were to meet at the G20 summit in Argentina this weekend. On Twitter, Trump said that his decision was based on the fact that the ships and sailors have not been returned to Ukraine from Russia. He added that he looks forward to a future meeting with Putin as soon as this situation is resolved. German Chancellor Angela Merkel said she does plan to meet with Putin at the G20 meetings. She said she will urge him to order the release of the Ukrainians and their ships. I'm Brian Lynn.
The only grand piano in the Palestinian territory of Gaza was played in public this week for the first time in 10 years. Palestinian and Japanese musicians played the piano for 300 people at a November 25th performance at the Palestine Red Crescent Society. For many, it was the first time they had ever heard a piano performed live. One Japanese pianist, Kaoru Imahigashi, said, "Playing this piano is feeling like playing history. It's amazing. I felt the prayer of peace for many people." The Japanese government donated the piano about 20 years ago, following temporary peace agreements between Israel and the Palestinians. The piano was placed in a large theater at the Al Naras Resort in northern Gaza. A culture ministry official explained that music events were a regular activity there before conflicts between Palestinians and Israelis began again in 2000. In 2007, the Islamic militant group Hamas took control of Gaza by force after winning legislative elections. Under Hamas rule, many forms of public entertainment were closed, including movie theaters and performance spaces. As a result, the Al Naras Resort closed its theater and swimming pool. The resort closed permanently in January 2009. The piano sat unused until 2014. An Israeli airstrike that year destroyed the Al Naras Theater. The piano was found undamaged but unplayable. The Belgian nonprofit group Music Fund supports music education in the Palestinian areas. In 2015, the group sent a French expert to Gaza to repair the piano. Another expert traveled there in October to make final repairs on the instrument. On the night of the performance, all 300 seats of the theater at the Palestine Red Crescent Society were filled. Fans of all ages listened intensely and applauded at the end of each performance. It was the first time that 22-year-old Yasmin Elian had attended a piano concert. She said after the concert, "This encourages me to learn piano."
Beautiful in Washington, D.C. this morning. I could see the sun shining and hear birds singing, so I decided to walk to work. As I walked down 6th Street, I smelled a delicious scent. I followed it and found a lovely French bakery. There, I saw all kinds of baked goods. So, I bought a delicious croissant, and it tasted wonderful. Now that I'm here, I can tell you all about sense verbs, verbs related to the five senses: smell, hearing, sight, taste, and touch. Some senses have more than one verb. We'll see examples of many of them today. But first, let's learn what makes these verbs so special. To start, sense verbs can act as linking verbs or action verbs, giving each verb two or more meanings. Linking verbs connect the subject to a word or group of words that describe or identify it. Take the sentence, "My forehead feels hot." Here, "feels" is a linking verb. It connects the subject, my forehead, to the description of it, hot. But as action verbs, sense verbs describe a physical or mental action. For example, I felt my forehead and I touched my forehead use action verbs. They express having put one's hand on the forehead, which is a physical action. Second, linking verbs and action verbs have different sentence structure. For linking verbs, the structure is subject plus linking verb plus more information about the subject. As linking verbs, sense verbs are often followed by adjectives or the word like plus a noun phrase. They are not followed by objects or adverbs. In the sentence, "My forehead feels hot," the word hot is an adjective that describes the subject, my forehead. We do not use adverbs such as hotly after linking verbs. And if I say, "My forehead feels like a frying pan," I am using the linking verb structure like plus a noun phrase. The noun phrase is a frying pan. For action verbs, the structure is subject plus action verb plus the rest of the sentence. As action verbs, sense verbs are often followed by objects. In the sentence, "I touched my forehead," the words "my forehead" are the object. Third, we do not usually use sense linking verbs in continuous forms, the be plus ing verb forms. We would not say, for example, "My forehead is feeling hot," even if it is happening right now. But as action verbs, we sometimes do use sense verbs in the continuous form. For example, someone might ask by phone, "Did you taste the food?" And the other person might answer, "I am tasting it right now." Okay, now let's play a game. I will give you two examples for each sense. Your job is to think about which uses a linking verb and which uses an action verb. Here's a hint. If you can replace the verb with is and the sentence still makes sense, it is probably a linking verb. For example, if I replace feel with is, the sentence "my forehead is hot" still makes sense. We will start with the sense of touch. One example is about physical touch. The other is a description of a physical state.
"Feel my skin. It's so dry."
"Your skin does feel dry. Here, use my lotion."
Now let's try the verb smell. One meaning is about using the nose to physically take in a smell. The other is about noticing the smell of something.
"She leaned over and smelled the food."
"Your food smells delicious. Can I have some?"
Next is the verb taste. One meaning is to take a small amount of food into the mouth to learn its flavor. The other describes the flavor of something.
"Can you taste the fish? I added more lemon."
"I just tried it. It tastes like a big lemon."
For the sense of sight, we can use the verb see or look, depending on what we want to say.
"It's really dark in here. I can't see anything."
"I just found the lights. Wow, you look frightened."
And finally, we move to the sense of hearing. We can use the verb hear or sound, depending on what we want to say. Now for examples.
"I hear singing outside my window. I wonder who it is."
"Your voice sounds lovely. Where'd you learn to sing?"
Well, we hope you liked what you heard. See you next week. I'm Alice Bryant.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In May of 1787, a group of America's early leaders met in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They planned to amend the Articles of Confederation. That document established a loose union of the 13 states. Instead, the leaders wrote a completely new constitution. It created America's system of government and recognized the rights of its citizens. Last week, we told how the group reached agreement on the position and powers of a national executive. They decided the executive could veto laws, and they decided the person could be removed from office if found guilty of serious crimes. We also told about the debate on a national judiciary. The delegates approved a federal system of courts and judges. These courts would hear cases involving national laws, the rights of American citizens, and wrongdoing by foreign citizens in the country. State courts would continue to hear cases involving state laws. Next, the delegates began to discuss competing proposals for a national legislature. This would be the most hotly debated issue of the convention. It forced the question of equal representation. Would small states and large states have an equal voice in the central government? The convention had already agreed that the national legislature would have two houses. It had not agreed, however, on the number of representatives each state would have in each house. The large states wanted representation based on population, but the small states believed they would lose power to the large states. They wanted representation to be the same for all states, no matter what the size. One day, Gunning Bedford of Delaware, one of the smallest states, looked straight at the delegates from the largest states. "Gentlemen," he shouted, "I do not trust you. If you try to crush the small states, you will destroy the Confederation. And if you do, the small states will find some foreign ally of more honor and good faith who will take them by the hand and give them justice." The debate on legislative representation, big states against small states, lasted for weeks that summer in Philadelphia. The delegates could not agree, so they debated other parts of the proposal. One involved the names of the two houses of the legislature. Most spoke of them simply as the first branch and the second branch. We will speak of them by the names used today, the House of Representatives and the Senate. Next came the question, who could be elected to the House and Senate? Delegates did not take long to decide. Members of the House, they agreed, must be at least 25 years old. They must have been citizens of the United States for 7 years. And at the time of election, they must live in the state in which they are chosen. The delegates agreed that members of the Senate must be at least 30 years old. They also must have been a citizen of the United States for 9 years. And at the time of election, they too must live in the state in which they are chosen. But who would elect them? The question raised an interesting issue. It concerned democracy. In 1787, the word democracy meant something very different from what it means today. To many of the men meeting in Philadelphia, democracy meant mob rule. To give power to the people was an invitation to anarchy. Still, George Mason of Virginia argued for popular elections. The people will be represented, Mason said, so they should choose their representatives. James Wilson of Pennsylvania agreed. He stated firmly that the people must elect at least one branch of the national legislature. That, he said, was a basic condition for free government. The majority of the convention agreed with Mason. The delegates decided that members of the House of Representatives should be elected directly by the people. Akhil Reed Amar is a professor at Yale Law School in Connecticut. He says the delegates' decision to let people elect their representatives helped change the meaning of the word democracy.
The success of the American Constitutional Project has proved to the rest of the world that democracy can work, government of, by, and for the people, can survive and flourish, and this has been a model for the rest of the world.
However, most delegates agreed that the state legislatures would choose the representatives to the second legislative branch, the Senate. It remained that way for more than 100 years. In 1913, the states approved the 17th Amendment to the Constitution. This amendment legalized the direct election of senators by the people. How long would lawmakers serve? Roger Sherman of Connecticut thought representatives to the House should be elected every year. Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts agreed. He thought a longer term would lead to a dictatorship. James Madison of Virginia protested. It will take almost 1 year, he said, just for lawmakers to travel to and from the seat of government. Madison proposed a 3-year term, but the delegates finally agreed on 2 years. There were many ideas about the term for senators. A few delegates thought they should be elected for life. In the end, the convention agreed on a Senate term of 6 years. Next came a debate about the pay for elected officials. How much should they get? Or should they be paid at all? Some delegates thought the states should pay their representatives to the national legislature. Others said the national legislature should decide its own pay and take it from the national treasury. That idea, James Madison argued, was shameful. He thought the amount should be set by the Constitution. Again, Madison lost the argument. The Constitution states only that lawmakers will be paid for their services and that the money will come from the national treasury. Finally, the time came for the convention to face the issue of representation in the House and Senate. The large states still wanted representation based on population, and the small states still wanted equal representation. The delegates had voted on the issue several times since the convention began. But both sides stood firm. Yet they knew they could not continue to vote forever, day after day. So the delegates did what large groups often do when they cannot reach agreement. They voted to create a committee. This grand committee would try to develop a compromise. The rest of the delegates would enjoy themselves during the July 4th holiday marking American independence. July 4th, Independence Day. It marked the 11th anniversary of America's Declaration of Independence from British rule. The celebration was especially important in Philadelphia. It was the city where the Declaration of Independence was signed. Now it was the city where a new nation was being created. Convention President George Washington led a group of delegates to a ceremony at a Philadelphia church. They heard a speech written especially for them. "Your country looks to you with both worry and hope," the speaker said. "Your country depends on your decisions. Your country believes that men such as you, who led us in our war for independence, will know how to plan a government that will be good for all Americans. Surely we have the ability to design a government that will protect the liberties we have won." After the speech, Benjamin Franklin urged the convention to ask for God's help. He said each meeting should begin with a prayer. Hugh Williamson of North Carolina quickly ended any discussion of Franklin's idea. The convention, he said, had no money to pay a minister to lead the delegates in prayer. On July 5th, the Grand Committee presented a two-part compromise. It provided something for large states and something for small states. It called for representation based on population in the House and for equal representation in the Senate. The committee said both parts of the compromise must be accepted or both rejected. Delegates debated the compromise for many days. They knew if they did not reach agreement, the convention would fail. Those were dark days in Philadelphia. Later, Luther Martin of Maryland noted that the newspapers reported on how much the delegates agreed. But that was not the truth. "We were on the edge of breaking up," Martin said. "We were held together only by the strength of a hair." Delegates Robert Yates and John Lansing of New York had left the convention in protest. But George Mason of Virginia declared he would bury his bones in Philadelphia before he would leave without an agreement. Even General George Washington was depressed. He wrote to Alexander Hamilton, who had returned to New York temporarily. "I am sorry you went away," Washington said. "Our discussions are now, if possible, worse than ever. There is little agreement on which a good government can be formed. I have lost almost all hope of seeing a successful end to the convention, and so I regret that I agreed to take part." On July 16th, the convention voted on the issue for the last time. It accepted what is called the Great Compromise. But even this agreement raised another problem. If representation was based on population, who would you count? Would you count just free people? Or would you count Negro slaves too?
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.